my mother could come to me in an astral visit while I slept. Those were unconscious, and I would be able to distinguish between a visit, which is incredibly vivid, and an ordinary dream. That would be fine. But it would be like me watching something on tape. I wanted conscious, live, real-time messages confirming that she was okay. There was only one requirement. They had to come through other people. She would have to use other mediums, so I could be sure that I wasn't tricking myself. We decided on 3 signs that she could use to validate that it was her. First, an easy one, princess. She could show Princess Diana, she could show a crown, she could even show a pink telephone, or she could just say her name. The next sign would be something that was very special between us. Ever since I was a little boy, I had a thing for Winnie the Pooh. I mean, an obsession. I started out in kindergarten with a singular Pooh who came with me to school. I kept him in my knapsack, and nobody knew he was there but me. Right. At lunch, I would take him out so that he could breathe. Soon, I tired of just one Pooh and demanded more and more Winnies. No matter how many I had to have more. I had Winnie sheets, Winnie music, Winnie posters. My mother started calling me Winnie. I dragged her to see Winnie the Pooh and Tinkertoo 17 times. The second sign had to be something that had to do with a Pooh Bear. And then the last sign. I wanted my mom to make an allusion to something that had become a ritual for me. Guiding Light, 3 o'clock, Channel 2. I had been watching it religiously for more than 10 years, and now, in these grim days, watching my mom slip away day by day, the soap became an essential diversion for me. My mom wanted to die at home, so I arranged for hospice care. I would spend hours with her, taking only one break when the caretaker was there. Each afternoon at 3, I would excuse myself and go to the living room to watch Guiding Light with Granny. I'm going to Springfield, I'd say. Guiding Light, I told Mom at her bedside. That's the third sign. But I realized that might be a hard one for her to get across, unless I happened to be with a medium who was a fan. So I gave her an easier way. Take me to Springfield, I said. I don't care if it's Springfield, Illinois, or Springfield Boulevard. You can show a spring and a field. I don't care how you do it, but just get me to Springfield. Get me to Guiding Light in some way. Johnny, I'll do my best, she said. That night, I made a vow that I would not reveal the 3 signs to anyone. I wanted to be sure, beyond any doubt, that when they came directly from her. One day, a couple of weeks later, with her room crowded with relatives, my mother looked at me and started telling me how sad she was that she wouldn't live to see my 21st birthday. The others began to get teary and started clearing out to leave us alone. My mother and I didn't cry. We wanted to be strong for each other. This was the moment some people never get a chance to have, a one last time on this side. She gave me a gold ring and a matching diamond bracelet for the birthday she wouldn't be around to celebrate with me. She wanted to leave me with this moment of love, and I wanted to give her the same thing to take with her on her impending journey. We were both absorbing the power of this bond that we knew would not end just because she was leaving me physically. My mother departed at 4 in the morning, surrounded by her family. A few seconds after she took her last breath, I walked out of her bedroom and into mine and began to talk to her, trying to help her make the transition to the other side. I told her she would be okay and that soon she would be greeted by her father and by Uncle Carmine. And then I asked her to give me a quick sign that she had arrived, that it was as blissful and blessedly unworldly as I thought. I wasn't asking for one of the signs we had talked about that needed to come through another medium. Something tangible that I would see. I asked her to show me a white bird. It had to be personal, not just a random white bird flying in the sky. It had to be obvious that it was meant for me. And I had to know that there really was another side and that she had arrived safely. A sickening wave of uncertainty was washing over me, and suddenly I had the same fear of the unknown that everyone else feels. I told my mom to go toward the light and let me know she's safe. On the afternoon of the last day of the wake, my cousin Anthony came over to comfort me. "So many flowers," he said, "but yours stands out the most. Those white birds are beautiful." I went over and saw that there were 2 plastic, feathered white birds nested in a colorful arrangement. I'd overlooked them for 3 days. "Why did you say they were my flowers?" I asked my cousin. "I don't know," he said. "Didn't Roseanne and Joey pick them out for you?" They did. I asked my cousins if they'd requested the birds. They said they hadn't. I called the florist and asked the owner why there had been birds in my flowers. "Oh, I'm sorry. Those were for confirmations," he said. "We were very busy yesterday, and one of the girls must have put them on there by mistake. I'm very, very sorry." "Well, no apology necessary," I said. "They were beautiful." On that last day of the wake, I found my favorite Pooh Bear and brought it to the funeral home. After everybody left and I was alone with my mom for the last time, I tucked the little bear in next to her in the casket, and the next day she was buried with it. My mom's death, of course, was a profoundly sad time in my life, one that stays with me all these years later. But it changed my life in a positive way also. My sense of loss, my need to somehow stay connected to my mom, although we were separated by this mysterious dimension between the physical world and the spiritual one, was so powerful that it was nothing short of a revelation. Oh my God, so that's how all these people feel. Mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, husbands, wives, they all went to mediums to lessen their pain, to keep the kind of bonds that I needed so desperately now. If I can do this for them, I realized, then I have to. Busted. I got an application to vet school, I told Mark almost exactly 10 years later. "Shit, you're serious," he said. "Look," Mark said, "stop feeling sorry for yourself. You've been through this before. You'll go through this again. God gave you this great ability. How can you think of not using it? What other work could you do that could bring so much peace to people? Look at me. I'm an accountant. How much peace and comfort do you think I bring people? I call people and say, 'You owed $50, but I got it down to $10. I laughed and told Mark, "All right, you made your point." But I still felt lousy. I didn't rip up the application to vet school. Not yet. Anyway, as you have probably surmised, I decided not to become a pet doctor, which meant I had to confront what the past 9 months had been all about. It wasn't as simple as "that's life." That's not how my life works. Things happen for a reason. As I slowly climbed out of my little abyss, I began to realize that it wasn't unappreciated people who were making me so unhappy. I was basically using them, the very people I had set out to help, as scapegoats for what was really bugging me. I was angry at myself. I had let my guides down. I had failed to achieve what I was supposed to. I had screwed up. By this time in my life, my guides and I had been through a lot together. It's a unique relationship, to say the least. Everyone has guides to assist them and give them insight. But for most people, the connection is subtle, even imperceptible. I may be more in tune with my guides, but they're no different from anyone else's. They aren't there to make my decisions for me, but to help me find my way to the right ones, even if it sometimes means making things happen so the decision is a little easier. They shine a light, nudge me, and then let me use my free will based on the lessons I've learned. It's kind of a collegial professional relationship. They're like an oversight committee, a group of 5 or 6, based on the energies I've sensed that seems to guide by consensus. They will pull me in one direction or the other. I never hear a minority opinion. So what was this personal guidance committee making of the direction I was taking back in 1998, when book royalties and infomercials were in the atmosphere? This was the question I had been avoiding. Now it was time to deal with it. The business side of the psychic life is tricky stuff. This is spiritual work, yet there's no denying that if you have an ability or talent, it's possible to earn a living at it. Some may even make a lot of money at it. Few actually do. But they are the ones who carry the burden of public perception for everyone else. When I made my decision to actually make a career out of this, I had to come to an arrangement with my guides. Call it an understanding. As long as I didn't make it about money, I would be okay. As long as the work stayed front and center, they would take care of me. So here's my rule. It's okay to want to earn a living as a medium, even a good living, and it's okay to succeed. What's not okay is stepping over the fine line between simple human desire and simple human greed. For me, if I cross it, I'm toast. That's not to say I can't do things that would bring me financial rewards. I just can't use money as the measure of my success. I can't use a calculator as my moral compass. And I can't abuse my abilities by charging an obscene fee for a private reading just because that's what the market will bear. And really, it's not that my field is so special. In any career, if you make it about the work first, the money will take care of itself. You don't have to be a spiritual person to embrace this ethic, and you don't have to be a Wall Street shark to lose sight of it, especially if you also allow yourself to fall prey to some of the other human impulses, competition with peers, resentment at being left behind, or the desire for control and power. I'm always saying that it's not the spirits who are getting it wrong, it's more likely that I'm misinterpreting their messages. So now, as I decompressed from my recent crash and burn, I began to consider whether I had misinterpreted my guide's messages all those years. Did I allow myself to become so seduced by the expectation of what they were showing me, really since the day Lydia Clark sat in my bedroom and told me I would be a famous psychic, that I began to think of it as some sort of entitlement? I never stopped honoring the work. Bringing knowledge and comfort to a lot of people remained my goal. I also held to the principle that if I could earn my money via books, tapes, or a ticket to a seminar, I wouldn't even have to think about how much I earned from the one-on-one readings that I felt were important to keep doing, no matter how successful I became. Still, I had to acknowledge that humanity might have lost some ground lately to the impulse to cash in. That was never my intention or motivation, but it might have seemed that way to any spirit guides who happened to be looking in. So now, the boys were slapping me silly. They were busting me. I'm not supposed to be out front, I finally decided. At least not now. I'm supposed to do the work. Do my readings in my office and my lectures at the hotels, and continue trying to raise the understanding of spirit communication. But it was time to slow down, breathe deep, and put some spirituality back into this hard-driving turbo medium thing I had going. I had been operating under the assumption that I had to do it all now. Of course, I didn't have to do it all at once. First, I had a lesson to learn. If I was going to climb onto a big stage, I had to get a peek behind the curtains. I needed to go through the experience of losing perspective and screwing up. And I needed to learn how to recognize and cope with people who might not necessarily put the work first. I'd never be able to control the actions of people I dealt with, and definitely not their motives and attitudes. But I could damn well control my own. As soon as I reconnected with that value, I was back on track. Reva and the Princess. Soon after my mother's death in 1989, I had begun a grand quest for the three signs. It was exactly the kind of narrow-minded and misguided search that I'm always scolding my audiences and clients about. Never mind that over the next few years, I would have two amazing visits from my mother in dreams, or that several times colleagues would pass on messages that I knew were from her. They weren't the messages I wanted to hear. The White Bird of the Wake, which wasn't technically one of them, only fueled my desire for the big three. When I tell people to come into a reading without any expectations, I know how wickedly hard it can be, and for a long time, I couldn't do it. I started making appointments with other mediums I knew or had heard of. But the first sign came during a reading my cousin Joey had with a medium in my area. Joey wanted to connect with his father, my Uncle Carmine. But during the reading, it was an aunt with a P name that came through. Joey, who was close to my mom, was skeptical and basically challenged the medium to come up with the whole name. "She's telling me to say princess?" the medium said, apparently thinking that this could not possibly be. But Joey laughed and said, yes, she was Aunt Princess. She wanted Joey to know that she and his father were together and fine. Joey came over and brought me a present, a tape of the session. I was slightly disappointed that the first message, the first sign, had come through my cousin and not more directly to me, but I wasn't going to argue. I figured that my mother wanted Joey to know his father was with her and he was fine. I was sure she would give the other two signs to me and before too long. I figured that any decent medium would get at least one of the two. And being in the business, if only a junior member of the fraternity, I had no trouble finding my way to mediums. Some I knew, such as Shelley Peck, and some I didn't. I must have seen 8 or 10 in my pursuit of confirmation, visiting some of them 2 or 3 times. I went to the same medium Joey had been to. Nothing. Others got good, validating information, but not the signs. I wanted the signs. A year passed, then 2, then 3. My mother was really starting to annoy and frustrate me. I mean, between private readings by my colleagues and events where I shared a stage with them, she had more than ample opportunity to put me out of my misery. I began working on one last time, and I assumed I would have the signs by the time it was finished. I really wanted to be able to write in the book that I'd gotten all three. But all I was able to say in the book was, check your expectations at the door, because these spirits ain't giving you what you want to hear. Even I get what they give me, and I have connections. 9 years had passed now, and obviously my mother had her reasons for making me wait. She taught me a lot about life, and this was a lesson too. Still, I knew she would have come through eventually, when she felt the time was right. I made sure to continue protecting the integrity of our pact. I did not reveal the missing signs in the book. Rick, my collaborator, asked, but I wouldn't tell him. I didn't even tell my wife, Sandra. I didn't tell anyone. In September of 1998, I happened onto a new book by a medium I hadn't heard of before. It was called Contacting the Spirit World, and it was a guide for people who want to develop their own abilities to connect with that world. This book knocked me out. It was written in a very straightforward, matter-of-fact, useful way. No fluffy psychic babble about love and peace and someone standing behind you playing with your hair. I was so impressed with the book that when I finished it, I was probably like everybody else. I wanted a reading with the author. Her name was Linda Williamson, and apparently she was from Britain. I asked Denise Silvestro, my editor at Berkeley, if she could help me. Denise got me Linda Williamson's phone number, and I couldn't wait to call her. It was 10 at night in New York, and that would be, well, very late in England. Hello? I heard in a very sleepy English accent. Uh-oh. She politely let me know what time it was in her part of the world, but she did not seem to mind that much. She was excited that one of her fellow mediums was calling from America to say how much he liked her book. She, of course, was no more aware of me than I was aware of her. Would you be ever so kind and ring me up in the morning? She requested. Well, the next morning, I got up all excited, because Linda was going to give me a phenomenal phone session. I knew it, and I felt it. I had such a strong feeling that this was going to be what I had waited 9 years for, that I just thought she was going to get on the phone and say, "Hello, John, I have your mother, Perinda, here. She died of lung cancer on October 5th, and she wants me to tell you, Princess and Springfield, and thanks for putting the Pooh Bear in the coffin." Well, there I go again. Easy, boy, take a chill on those expectations. I call her, ready to go. I have my phone headset on that I use when I do radio shows or phone readings. I've got my pen and my legal pad. I'm ready to throttle up the speed writing I learned in high school. "I'm very excited to be doing this," Linda says. "I have a lovely woman here, and she's standing behind you." Oh, no. "And she's sending much love, and..." Well, I'm crushed. She can't be one of those. That's not what her book was about. Well, I totally shut down. Instead of listening to what she's saying and thinking about it, I just write it down, for lack of anything better to do. She keeps talking, and in return, I only offer an occasional grunt of indifference. She tosses out some stuff and asks me to validate it. "Uh-huh. Yeah. No. Okay." I've already sold my stock in her. She's not going to be the IPO who's going to make me millions. To me, she's a gypsy fortune teller on the streets of Lower Manhattan. But I'll tell you, she gives you money's worth. I'll give her that. I'm already on page 6 of my notes, and I hear, "Your mom is telling me to tell you that she was your guiding light," she says. "Not really," I reply dismissively. "She gave me a lot of direction, but I don't know if I'd call her that." "Oh, dear." "What?" "Your mom is quite a forceful woman, you know." "Well, she could be, but I'm not giving her an inch here." Now Linda changes her tone and she slows down. She lowers her voice as if something momentous is coming. "She wants me to tell you..." And I'm like, "Yeah, okay, what's my big message here?" And she pauses. "Guiding light." Silence on my end. Then, kaboom. That's it. Gone. Done. Case closed. Can't speak. Tears pouring out. 9 years of anticipation erupt in a spectacle of pent-up emotion. Sandra walks in, sees like I'm a mess, and says, "Oh God, who died?" I try to pull myself together, and I still haven't been able to say a word, so Linda has no idea that she has just become my new best friend. "You're a very difficult young lad to read," she says. "You don't really offer up much validation. I don't know if what I've said to you made any sense." "Linda," I said, finally able to say more than one word at a time, "it made more sense than I could possibly tell you." I told her the whole story, and she said in her understated British way, "Well, I'm glad I was able to help you." And then I thought about how amazing my mom is. It was so obvious what the last 9 years had been about. By holding back all that time, she was making a point that she had wanted me to drive home in my work, the problem of expectations. She wanted me to teach through my own experience. Here I was, a professional medium who knows all the pitfalls, and I was doing the very human thing of holding out for that one nugget that I just had to hear, as if it contained the secrets of the universe, or at least the meaning of life. As if hearing the name of a soap opera would really change anything. I already knew my mother was around, leading an active afterlife. Look at all the stuff I had let pass right by me because I didn't want to miss the big one. Stuff now I can't even remember. That's how much I ignored it. Great gifts of validation from mediums who just weren't delivering the packages I had ordered. So I returned them, and it was a ridiculous thing to do. Still, I know why I did it, and I know why everybody else does it. If you get the one thing you're asking for, it seems like a slightly higher level of validation. It's as if your mother or your husband or your daughter is answering you directly. And if that's happening, it really means that they are there. As if they got a phone call through from a constellation so far away it hasn't been discovered. On an emotional level, that's incredibly powerful. And it's wonderful if you get it. Witness the sentimental wreck I became when a woman I'd never met said two words to me over the phone from across an ocean. But what if you don't get it? Does that mean they're not there? Does it mean there's no afterlife? What if a medium can't get that information, but instead they can get something else? If it's a solid, specific, factual validation, does that make it any less valuable? This is the inevitable trap of the great expectation. The Amazing Donna. In January of 1997, Newsday, the large Long Island newspaper, published a very unusual story in its Sunday feature section. "Is John Edward communicating with the dead?" the headline asked. What made the story unusual was that it wasn't about poking fun or taking easy shots or dismissing what I and others do as cold reading, lucky guessing, or executing some absurdly elaborate con game. It was the most objective, open-minded, and genuinely inquisitive article that I had ever read about spirit communication in a mainstream publication. It was also the first major story about me. Beginner's luck, I guess. The writer, Bill Falk, had called and said he had heard about me from a colleague who knew someone who had a reading with me. He was intrigued and wanted to spend some time exploring what I do. Already wary of the press, I knew my elder colleagues weren't always treated with respect. And I myself had been mocked in a couple of small news articles. I called a journalist friend and asked him what he knew about Falk. He told me he was a serious journalist with an investigative bent and a solid reputation. "He won't do a hatchet job," my friend said. "He's exactly the kind of guy you want to write about you." Bill Falk took the time to interview me in depth and independently explore the phenomenon. Falk interviewed others and observed Shelley Peck. He also did the obligatory interview with James Randi, who has the distinction of being a person in America who lists his occupation as skeptic and uses the preferred first name, The Amazing. I've never met Mr. Amazing, but he seems to know all about me. He must be psychic. Falk concluded his 5,000-word story with an amazingly bold statement for a serious journalist to make in a major publication. And I quote, "Either Edward and Peck are getting these details from conversations with the spirit world, or they conjured up all this information through some unimaginably clever form of guesswork. Given all the evidence, I'm left with the strange conclusion that it makes more sense to believe they're communicating with the dead." But Bill Falk's story was not only a brave piece of journalism, it was also a key link in a chain of events that ultimately gave me a gift I couldn't have predicted. Bill never knew how powerful his story really was. And now he will. Donna Marie, a pseudonym, was about my age and taught high school biology. Her dad had died in November of 1995, and after seeing Bill's story in Newsday, she called my office for an appointment. Almost as soon as we began the reading, Donna's father came through. "He's telling me he already knows your children," I said. "He's talking about Anthony, who will come down and be your son. He's telling me specifically Anthony, not Tony." Donna said she had just gotten married and had no children yet, but she had always known that someday she would have a son named Anthony. In fact, her father used to tease her that he would call his grandson Tony, and she would say, "No, not Tony, Anthony." Her father's message now was a powerful solace to Donna. At the end of the reading, I told Donna how much I had enjoyed meeting her, and it turned out that I knew her husband's cousin. We were from the same world. "I feel like I know you," I said. "I feel like I know your father." Donna came to a group reading a couple of months later, and she and a friend, a fellow teacher, signed up for another one I was having at a Holiday Inn in November. But the timing was bad, or so it seemed. That night, her grandfather, who had been in a nursing home with Alzheimer's, was slipping away. He was near the end, and all the family was there, Donna told me later. A nurse said, "He'll probably go tonight." And people were telling him, "It's okay, you can go," even though he wasn't hearing them. Donna wanted to stay with her relatives at her grandfather's bedside, but she also felt she had an obligation to her friend. "I felt terrible because her husband and her son had died 6 months apart, and she was a mess. She didn't believe in an afterlife, but she wanted to. We had waited 6 months to go to the lecture. At the nursing home, everyone said, 'Donna, go, it's okay.' So I decided to go. I bent down and whispered, 'Grandpa, please wait till I get back.' I felt so bad leaving." Donna drove to the hotel and met her friend. I read about half the people, and Donna wasn't among them. And then we took a 10-minute bathroom break. And during that time, I saw Donna in the hallway, crying. My first thought, to be honest, was annoyance. "I can't believe that," I thought to myself. I thought she wanted to hear again from her dad and was upset when he didn't come through right away. We went back into the room, and I resumed the readings. I read one woman and then felt pulled in Donna's direction, and by now, she was composed. "Your dad's here," I said. "Oh, he's got people with him. Did your grandfather pass?" Donna nodded and began to cry again. "Wait a minute," I said. "Did he just pass? He's like really new." "A half hour ago," she managed to say. That's what Donna had been crying about in the hallway. She had gotten a call from her mother on her cell phone saying her grandfather had just crossed over, and now he was coming through. But he was in the background, and Donna's father was doing the talking. "You just came from the hospital?" I said to Donna. "You were having a party. There were two parties." Donna said she and her family had celebrated her grandfather's 80th birthday in the dining room of the nursing home the week before, and the balloons were still up, and tonight they had ordered food in for all of the family. "Your grandfather is here, but your father's speaking for him because he's so new. He wants to tell everyone he heard everything they said, and he says thank you because it made it easier." Although he wasn't saying much, Donna's grandfather was coming through with great energy. "He feels like Superman. He's just zooming around. He's so happy to be here. Like he's liberated. Like he's been asleep for 60 days. There's a lot of energy over there. It's like he went from one party to another. And there's a crowd with him." I was getting showered with names and sounds. Rose. Gregory. There were a lot of people who greeted him. They wanted him to come, and they wanted you to come here to get the message. That was the reason everybody told you to come. So don't be upset that you weren't there. You had a much more important job to do. Donna's grandfather seemed to be really loving this. He was making me feel his personality. He's like a politician working the room. "That's so him," Donna said. When I talked to Donna about that night many months later, she still couldn't believe it. "This was so surreal," she said. "My grandfather had just passed, and he was like checking in." Donna became captivated by spirit communication for the same reason I did. "My father died so suddenly," she explained. "It was such a shock. One day he was here, the next, boom. Ever since then, I wanted to know where he is. What is he doing? And what's it like over there? I had this quest of wanting to know what the other side looked like. I would go to Borders and get stacks and stacks of books about people's experiences. I would read them straight through in one night. I didn't even know who wrote them. I was like obsessed." But she wasn't content to read about other people's experiences or even to come to readings and lectures and hear someone else tell what it was like. She wanted a more direct connection. She wanted to see if she could develop her own abilities. That's something I try to encourage people to do. So from time to time, I present a workshop called Building Bridges. Donna attended one I gave the summer after I first met her, in the summer of 1997. After the workshop, Donna began to dabble at home. She would practice with her sister-in-law. "I tried getting things on Jean's brother," Donna said, and she validated them. Things about her brother's personality, about her wedding. He was a high-functioning Down syndrome, and I totally got his personality. I said, wow, maybe I'm really doing this. I got a great feeling from it because I was giving Gene such a tremendous thing. Well, I talked to Donna from time to time, and I always told her that I thought she should keep working on her abilities. And over the next couple of years, she would occasionally practice on Gene. She wasn't bold enough to ask anyone else, so there was a limit to how much she could develop. And besides that, she had gotten busy. She had had her first child, not a son named Anthony, but a daughter she and her husband Tommy named Julia. One night in October 1999, Donna was sitting in the rocking chair in her baby's nursery, just watching her sleep. She wondered if anything would come through if there wasn't anyone in the house except Julia. John, you're going to think I'm crazy, Donna said on the phone. I don't know if this was your mom. It looked just like her from the picture in the video. She told me to tell you Carol and Annette, or maybe Antoinette. A friend of mine named Carol was starting to spend some of her free time helping me organize my office, and Antoinette was a woman who had just been hired to do publicity for a tour I was doing. And then I asked her for a stronger validation, and she said, Pooh, and then this morning, Bear. Oh my God, I said, do you know what you just did? That was my third symbol. I was more composed this time, and after the guiding light message, this was just icing on the cake. I was thrilled to get it. But by now, I had come to understand that I shouldn't get much more excited by the Pooh Bear than by any other validation. After the Pooh Bear message, I told Donna not to expect to hear from my mother anytime soon, if ever. But 2 weeks later, she had another visit. And when she first started trying to build bridges to the spirit world, Donna had gotten a marble notebook to write down everything that happened. But after a while, the only thing inside were records and notes of encounters with my mother. The first one was October 10th, 1999. The next was only 15 days later, on October 25th. Then another one a week later on November 2nd, 10 visits in all. The last one on July 11th, 2000. Some of the information she got was incredibly detailed, as accurate as any I've gotten in my own work. And early in June 2000, Donna came to see me and said she'd had what she thought was another visit from my mother a few days before. I've got to ask you this, she said. I've just got to ask you, in your bedroom, do you have a large dark wood bureau with a hutch and a mirror? Because your mom showed me your bedroom. The furniture is light wood, and if you pull out the top right-hand drawer, there's a little box with a letter in it from your mom, or some type of piece of paper with writing on it. I'm seeing this like a movie. She's making me the camera, and she's wearing a blue dress. She shows me a shiny gold steering wheel. Well, Donna's description of my bedroom and the furniture in it was dead-on accurate. And in the bureau she described, there is only one drawer that's mine. And of course, all the others are Sandra's. And in that one drawer is my mom's old red jewelry box, which has some of her old jewelry, along with some of mine. And with the jewelry is a folded-up letter my mother wrote, specifying who should get what jewelry. The gold steering wheel? I'm not sure, but I had just gotten a new car. Donna continued relating the latest visit. I said to her, tell me something you used to say to John all the time. And she gave me the song, C'est la vie. It was one of those one-hit wonders in the 80s. I heard it on the radio all the time, and Donna had heard it in her head then. My mom said that to me all the time, I said when Donna told me this. I would ask her if it was Italian. Donna says it wasn't until my mother gave her the Pooh image that she believed she might actually be able to do spirit communication. I wasn't even trying to get her, she said. Why did she choose me? That's when I started feeling that maybe there was something to this. I began encouraging Donna to work on her abilities, just as Lydia Clar and Sandy Anastasi and Shelley Peck urged me to do years ago. And most important, I told Donna, she had to do readings. Just as my guide summoned Lydia Clar to my house to get me going when I was 15, I believed I'm supposed to put Donna on her path. 3 times in my life, I've had people tell me that I was going to meet someone named Donna who had a baby and that I was going to help. 2 of them were fellow psychics. The other was my friend Ernie, who looked at me a few years ago and said, John, who's Donna? And it's also no accident that my mother chose Donna to relay the third and final sign, or that she has come to her so often. The Producers. The Tube. As you may have guessed, I'm a recovering TV junkie. well, maybe not quite recovering, but liking television and wanting to be on television are two very different things. When I first signed the contract to write One Last Time, I told the publicity people that they would have to figure out how to promote the book without putting me on the TV circuit. I didn't want my face on television, and I hated the idea that someone would be telling me I had to do this show or that show, and maybe it was a show that might sensationalize or belittle the subject matter. Control, especially of my medium work, is paramount to me. There was also a part of me that didn't feel right about doing what amounted to commercials for myself, hawking spirit communication like Paul Reiser selling 10 cents a minute on AT&T. Not happening. Happening, a year later. I was calling TV producers myself and asking them to put me on their shows. I'd had, say, a change of heart. The publicity people had sat me down and said, "John, listen very carefully. This is America. It's 1998. If you want to get your book into a lot of hands, you have to go on television." They were right, of course. If I wanted the book to be successful, I would have to get off my high horse and do what everybody else does. I mean, look how many books there are in Barnes & Noble. But that didn't mean I was willing to give up the big C, as in control. In the back of my mind, I thought that if I made enough contacts on my own, I might be able to pick and choose which shows I went on. My guides gave me the green light, or maybe a blinking yellow, to proceed with caution. I began calling the main phone number of shows and finding out who was in charge. Being the anal retentive person I am, I kept careful lists of contacts and phone numbers in a loose leaf binder, leaving a space to make notes of what people said when I called and how and when I should follow up. I began calling producers on two coasts, hoping to talk my way into somebody's studio. I wasn't in any position to be that particular, but I hoped if I made enough contacts, I could be. I mean, how hard could it be? I felt if they just talked to me, they would get a real good feeling of my work, not some hyped hocus-pocus mythology. I remembered a national show in 1994 called The Other Side, and they had kept trying to get me on to do topics like hauntings and poltergeists, evil spirits, and even spells. When I told them all I wanted to do was come on and do what I do, they told me, "Thanks, but no thanks, it was already being done." Now, 4 years later, it seemed that if this was something already done, it was making a nice comeback. People who talked to dead people were positively trendy, and the ones with books were always getting on television. So at least they would know what I was talking about. But of course, there was always the risk that this time, it really was already done. Oh no, not another medium. Because as far as I could tell, there were still more TV shows with time to fill than mediums with books to sell. One of the first shows I called was Lisa. I liked Lisa Gibbons. I had a contact at Lisa, a producer named Joyce, whom I had called some time earlier. I knew she was a spiritual person, but didn't think she was into the psychic stuff. Still, she was a good place to start. And when I called, though, someone else answered her phone and told me the producer I was trying to reach had left the show. "Oh," I said, "is there someone else I can talk to about an idea that I have for a show?" "Well, you can talk to me," the woman said pleasantly. And her name was Raimi, and she explained that she was a special projects producer. It was her job to find unusual ideas, not your run-of-the-mill show with trailer park guests and all that stuff. "I've got some stuff I could send you," I said. I'd put together a little kit of my One Last Time video, some galleys of the book, and the Newsday article. "Do you think you might be able to look at it sometime?" "Sure," she said. So I packed up a box and put Raimi's name in my loose leaf binder. Raimi Warren Black, with a note to call her back in a few weeks, because I knew she was a TV producer and wouldn't call me. "You have to keep after them." I moved on to the next show on my list. There was a morning program called Fox After Breakfast that I thought might be interested. I called the person in my contact book, Paul Shavelson, the executive producer. I started my spiel, but he seemed to be only half listening. He said something polite like, "We're really not interested in doing that subject matter at this time," and while he passed me off to someone below him who said, "Yeah, I don't think we're going to be doing that kind of thing." Well, after a few more calls, I realized something. This is not like radio. In radio, you speak to the producer of the show. That's it. In television, it's like every show has 20 people, and all of them are producers. Executive producers, associate producers, just plain producers. You have to talk to four people before you can get to anybody who can actually make a decision, and then you're still nowhere because their decision is, Sorry, not at this time. Some of them were cocky TV types I probably was best to steer clear of anyway. A few days after I started making calls, the phone rang. Hi, John. This is Raimi from The Lisa Show. Really? Lisa? You're calling me back? I didn't think that you would. That's so cool. Well, Raimi came to New York in May for the Daytime Emmys, but we couldn't get our schedules to match. So it wasn't until October that we finally had a chance to meet in person. I was coming to Los Angeles with Rick Korn to meet with an old friend of his named Mark Gervitz, who was a partner and a head of the management division of Brillstein Gray Entertainment, which Rick informed me was a very major Hollywood agency that manages talent and produces shows. They did the Larry Sanders Show, and now they were starting production on another show for HBO, some kind of series about mobsters they were calling The Sopranos. Mark was putting together Just Shoot Me and was an executive producer of Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher, which got him an Emmy nomination. Rick obviously wanted me to meet Mark. He was convinced I should have my own television show. A sitcom about a psychic, maybe. The day before we were supposed to fly out, Rick phoned with some bad news. He'd gotten a call with what Rick considers the four ugliest words in the English language. We're going to pass. Brillstein Gray didn't do much syndication, which is what they considered the type of show Rick was talking about. They were interested in me, but their thing really was comedy. A show with a psychic medium didn't quite fit in. Well, we gave it a shot, Rick told me, trying not to sound too defeated. There'll be other opportunities. And there's a lot of other stuff to be excited about. The book, of course, and the infomercial that came out of the Larry King video fiasco. The direct marketing company had hired a really good producer-director from Los Angeles, and we were starting to plan it out. Although it was technically being called an infomercial, I saw it in a much less crass way. Maybe I was being naive, but I saw it more as educational television. Whatever I called it, Rick thought it couldn't miss. Still, he was disappointed about Brillstein Gray, much more than I was. But I told him not to cancel our flight. We were going to go to L.A. anyway. Why? He wanted to know, not surprisingly. What's up? Nothing, I said. We just need to go. But the meeting's canceled. I know, but I still need to go. For what? I don't know. I just know I need to be there. We can see the infomercial guys. And I'll call up this woman, Raimi, who's been so nice to me. All I know is, I've still got to go. So we flew out to California. With nothing much on the agenda, we drove up to Malibu. On the way back down Pacific Coast Highway, we pulled off to take a look at this other ocean. John, Rick said finally, why are we here? I don't know, I said, adding with laugh, maybe we just needed a vacation. We had called Chad Murdoch, the infomercial producer, and made plans to get together. But I knew that really wasn't why we had come. You know, I really think I need to meet this Raimi. I think that's why I'm here. Maybe she'll be able to help me with the book or something. By that time, Raimi Warren Black's professional life had changed in a big way. Over the summer, Paramount Productions had hired a new executive producer for the following season of Lisa, and he wanted to bring in his own people. So even though she had another year in her contract, she made a decision. She said to her husband in the car one day, "You know what? I'm done. I've had 20 years of talk, and that's enough. It's time to do Media Savvy." She worked out a settlement of her contract, called her partner-in-waiting, Adora English, and they decided it was time to jump off the cliff. Thelma and Louise were in business. When Raimi went out on her own, it meant that she was free to help me beyond her own show. And who better to explain me to producers than another producer? "You know what, John? I would love to do that," she said. "Great, you're hired." No, don't hire me. Just send me some books and let me make my 12 calls. I'm not a publicist, but I know what doors to go into. Adora and I have worked with all these people, and they're pretty much our friends. I can call my friend who's the executive producer of Sally, our friend who's the executive producer of Entertainment Tonight, so just let us make our calls, and it's either going to go or it's not. I could not believe it. My first Hollywood contact, and she turns out to be a total sweetheart. She just wanted to help. How cool was that? So now in late October, I figured that had to be why I was pulled across the country. I was supposed to meet Raimi, even though my original reason for going was called off. Chad and his assistant Nicole came up to my hotel room in West Hollywood, and we spent a couple of hours talking about the upcoming infomercial. And then a call came from the front desk saying Miss Black was on her way up. Raimi sat on the couch, and I took a chair. "I'm sorry to ambush you like this," I said, "but you didn't come alone, and do you want me to do this?" Oh, absolutely, she said. Have you ever had a reading before? I've been read a few times by psychics. I ran through the preliminaries, then took off my glasses and asked her for her watch to hold. I breathed deeply and listened. If you asked me what happened over the next 20 minutes or so, I really couldn't tell you very much. As is often the case, even for a great reading, I only remember a few highlights. I can summon the essence of it, the feelings and quality of it, but the details are like vapor. They're not my thoughts, so they pass through me without stopping to register in my brain. Fortunately, many people take careful notes. Others are able to remember the dialogue so accurately, it's as though they have a tape recorder in their heads. Raimi was in that group. She took out a notepad but didn't need it. She remembered everything and later wrote an account for herself. That's what most of the following is based on. One of the things I do remember is that the reading started strong, right out of the gate. There was a very pushy woman coming through, pointing me towards Raimi's right hand. "That's my ring," she was telling me. She was really aggressive about this ring, which had a diamond in the middle of it. Raimi told me that this was obviously her grandmother on her father's side. Pushy, she told me later. She was like Attila the Hun. As my mother says, and my mother's the nicest person in life, she was mean. The ring was indeed my grandmother's, and it has a very dramatic family story attached to it. Okay, who's Jimmy or Jim? I asked, according to Raimi's account. My cousin, she gasped, clasping her hands over her mouth and starting to cry. Suddenly, I knew the mystery was solved. Raimi was the reason I was here. Your family is the reason I'm here, I said. They got me on that plane. I assumed it was so they could get these messages to Raimi. What I didn't know was that it wasn't the only reason I was here. And Raimi's relatives weren't the only ones who wanted me to come to California and meet her. Jimmy wanted me to get to the point. He's saying not to worry about the separation between you. Let it go. He's telling me that there was something that came between you and a reason you couldn't get to him when he died. But he wants you to know that he's okay. He's with your father. Did your father not get to see you grow up? No, he died when I was very young. Because he's here too, and he wants you to know that he's very proud of you, and he's always known what was going on in your life. Were you very young because he didn't raise you? Raimi said, I was 18 months old. There's someone else here too, the man who did raise you. He's showing me a pink rose with thorns on it. That means he was unable to express love. My stepfather. He's saying happy birthday to someone. Oh my God, today is my sister's birthday. She's his biological daughter. This was one of those clear days when I could see and hear forever. Even the best readings have gaps, symbols that don't make sense, messages misinterpreted by me or misunderstood by the person I'm reading. But with Raimi's relatives, it was almost impossible to get it wrong. Well, he's showing me blackness down here, like in the intestinal area, I said of Raimi's stepfather. She replied, he died of an aneurysm in the intestine. Finally, they were pulling back, and I asked if she had any questions. She was so blown away that she couldn't even speak. And so the session ended. She looked down at the pad, and the only thing she'd written down was a D. There was something great about that. She had been in the experience so completely that she couldn't possibly take notes. We tried to have a friendly business dinner, talking about getting me on talk shows and to promote the book one last time, about the potential of an infomercial, and that Rick was discussing his ideas for a television show. But Raimi, sitting next to me and across from Rick, was someplace else. And finally she said, okay, wow, I really can't talk about any of this right now. I've got to talk about what just happened. Raimi started telling Rick about the reading, filling in some blanks for me. Rick listened to Raimi's recap. He had heard and observed more than a few stories like this just from being around me, but he was glad for Raimi. That's pretty amazing, he said. That's why I wanted to hook him up with my friend at Brillstein Gray, to see if maybe there's something here. Oh, absolutely there's something there, Raimi said. This is a show. I mean, if we could take what I just experienced and put it on the air, it would be so powerful. I can't say that wasn't nice to hear or that it took me completely by surprise. My guides had been giving me glimpses of a show for a while, and this was back when I was in my great expectations mode, before the crash. Still, my immediate concern was the book that was coming out in a matter of days, and the publisher's determination to get me on television. Raimi, I'm worried that they're going to book me on shows that I don't want to do. I don't want someone telling me, you have to do this, you have to do that. I really liked Raimi, and now that she had her own personal experience, she could really sell me to her friends who ran all these shows. I'll talk to them, and I'm sure I'll be able to get you booked. But really, forget other people's shows. You should have your own show. Can I do this? Raimi asked. Would you just let me try to do something? Sure, I said. Go right ahead. Raimi called her partner, Adora English, from the car on her way home from dinner. We're doing a show with John Edward, she told her. The Medium. Yeah, right, Adora English replied. No, really. The guy with the book, she said. Is this a joke? You're not going to believe what happened. I think it could be great television. Adora began to laugh uncontrollably. I can just see us in pitch meetings, she said. Yeah, we got this guy. He talks to the dead. It'll be great. Raimi knew it sounded a little crazy, but she really didn't care. The Tale of the Manatee. I got my own show right away. All right, it was the infomercial. Not exactly cutting-edge television, but it offered something I craved. Control. Or so I thought. We were shooting the infomercial at a waterfront house Chad had rented. And it was like he said, beautiful. A mansion right on Tampa Bay. A thread of the show was going to be Judy Guggenheim, a leading lady of after-death communication and co-author of the book Hello from Heaven. And she would be interviewing me about my work. Judy started with the basics, asking me to explain the difference between a psychic and a medium. I explained that all mediums are psychics, but not all psychics are mediums, and began a discourse on spirit communication. But then, maybe 10 minutes into the interview, I started feeling a connection and a pull. I was trying to focus on Judy's questions, trying to talk about how I get my information, when I started getting information. I knew the schedule was changing. The production crew was caught off guard. This was an infomercial. Spontaneity wasn't exactly their specialty. I felt like I was being pulled to my right, but when I explained that the energies coming through could be for anyone in the house, there was complete chaos. Now I was drawn to the back wall of the house. Who's over there? I asked, pointing to my right. I think I'm back over there. Chad looked over and saw a wall with nobody near it. Nobody's been there the whole time, he said. Yes, there was, I insisted. It's right over there. There had to be someone standing right there. Who's on the other side of that wall? Chad looked at me for a second, then took a breath as if something had clicked. Two sets of sliding glass doors flanked the wall. They led out to the patio, where he had set up a production table. He slid one of the doors open and leaned out. Nicole, would you come in? Chad's assistant producer, a woman in her 20s, poked her head in tentatively. She saw everyone looking at her. It's a male figure coming through, I said. There's an impact to the body. Oh my, Chad said. He definitely knew something. I looked at Nicole. This is for you, isn't it? Okay, clear the room, Chad said. Judy got up and gave Nicole her seat next to me. The sound man brought over a body mic. Ed, we're still rolling? Chad asked the cameraman, who nodded. Still rolling. Chad, it turned out, had suspected this might happen since the moment their plane from Los Angeles had touched down in Tampa. In fact, he had been hoping for it, although he had carefully avoided saying anything to me. As they were landing, Chad told me later, he saw that Nicole was crying. He asked her what was wrong. Remember the story I told you about Roger? She inquired softly. This is the first time I've been back here since then. Oh my gosh, Chad said. He hadn't connected it when they were searching for a location for the shoot. The worst thing that had ever happened to Nicole happened in Tampa. She had told him the story, but he didn't register the place. And now he had brought her back here. He hugged her and apologized. I'm going to get you through this, he said, I promise. Chad stood with Nicole as the sound guy attached her mic. She seemed to be bracing herself, nervously remarking that she had no shoes on. When she was ready, she looked at me uneasily. I stared away, focusing on the spirit who was so boldly barging in on our little infomercial shooting. Someone's coming through and they're making me feel like they passed for some type of head trauma. This would be something like an impact. There's a very strong bond of love that's connected here, and there's a feeling of unresolved, unfinished, but continued business, which is really strange for me. This is a male figure who passed, Nicole nodded yes and wiped away a tear. As Nicole later explained, her boyfriend Roger was from Tampa and was waiting for a job transfer to San Francisco, where she lived. They worked for the same San Francisco-based company and had met in the fall of 1996, when Roger came out for a business meeting. They clicked immediately, and when he went home to Florida, they began just about as long a long-distance relationship as you can have without leaving the continental United States. They talked 3 times a day, first thing in the morning, last thing at night, and once during the workday. They saw each other when Roger came to the West Coast on business, and twice when Nicole went to Tampa to visit him. In Florida, they spent almost all their time on Roger's boat. He loved being on the water. He told Nicole that he would be perfectly happy to quit his job and work as some captain's first mate. One Tuesday night at the end of April 1997, Roger called Nicole in what struck her as a strangely serene mood. He said, "You know what? All I want to do is enjoy myself and be happy. Just be a seaman somewhere and sail away." And that's the last thing he said to me. And I think, wow, it's almost like he knew. You look back on things. I was flying to Orange County for my girlfriend's wedding 2 nights later, on Thursday at around 8 p.m. I had a very warm sensation and I started crying on the plane. I looked out on the water as I was flying in, and there was this boat with all these lights. And I felt something and I thought of him. I was upset about how things had gone the last few months, but this was different. I had a very strange feeling, one of those things you can't explain and don't think about until after the fact. I found out later this happened just about the time they determined he died. That night in May, Roger had gone out into the Gulf, a longer trip than his twice daily jaunts around the bay. He never came back. The Coast Guard found his empty boat the next day. His body didn't surface for another 8 days. There was a fatal bullet wound in Roger's temple, and the death was ruled a homicide. The FBI took over the investigation because the boat had been found in international waters, but the case hadn't been solved. Roger offered no clues from the other side.